Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Orthodoxy partly extends its reach into 2025 with the Regulation 2 segments today, but three guests. Muin Rabbani will talk about the ceasefire deal in Gaza, and in a possibly jarring change of subject, Angela Jones and Bernadette Barton will talk about sex work today. Before all that, a few words on the reinstallation of Emperor Trump. There will be much to cover in the coming months on this alarming lesion, a task Muin Rabbani begins by talking about his Middle Eastern policy, whatever exactly that is. I just want to make a couple of points of my own right now. Moments ago, I looked at the White House website, whitehouse.gov. It features a Leni Riefenstahl-ish video montage, minus Riefenstahl's considerable skills, centering on the heroic figure of Trump, appointed by God to save us from collapse. It's frightening. The invocation of God, a Christian God, by Trump and his supporters is offensive to me, not that I'm a religious person, but that everything he and his movement, if that's what you want to call it, stand for, is at odds with the peace and love message one usually associates with Jesus. When the Trump gang was reminded of this by the Episcopal Archbishop of Washington the other day, he squirmed with discomfort, J.D. Vance rolled his eyes upward, and later a Republican congressman declared that she should be deported. The early torrent of executive orders, some of which, it's been said, look to have been written by ChatGPT, are just one horror after another, cracking down on trans people, immigrants, scientists, public health, free expression, wind energy, and much more, while promoting oil production, AI and crypto, and old-style land-grab imperialism. We have to see what he's going to do with tariffs, but he goes as big as he says he's going to raise consumer prices and set off a global trade war while doing nothing serious to promote domestic manufacturing. Corporate America, which had largely kept its distance during the campaign, is now lining up to kiss his ring. State power, seasoned with tax cuts and deregulation, is a hell of a drug. And then there's Elon Musk's fascist salute, which Democrats, the ADL, and the media can't even acknowledge, much less condemn. Much more to come. What about the Gaza ceasefire, and what does the Trump regime hold for the Middle East? Here to talk about that is Muin Rabbani, a journalist and analyst with a deep understanding of the region. He's served in several diplomatic roles over the years and is the co-editor of Jadalia, an e-zine that covers the region, where he also hosts his Connections podcast. Muin Rabbani. Okay, to start with, this deal, whatever it is, the ceasefire deal, is nearly identical to the outlines of one proposed in May. What were the details of that proposal, and then what happened? Why did it become okay 8 months later when it wasn't so good in May?
The deal consists of three stages, and the first stage essentially consists of a temporary suspension of hostilities, together with a limited Israeli-Palestinian exchange of captives and a surge in urgently needed humanitarian supplies into the Gaza Strip. The second stage, which is not yet finalized, and the negotiations on which are supposed to begin on day 16 of the first stage, which is supposed to last for a total of 42 days, we'll see a larger Israeli withdrawal from within the Gaza Strip, a reopening of the border crossing between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, a much broader exchange of captives, and of course a continuation of the suspension of hostilities. And if the third stage is then concluded and finalized, then we're really talking about an indefinite ceasefire and the completion of the exchange of captives, or rather at that stage, any remaining bodies held by the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip will be handed over to the Israelis in exchange, I presume, for additional Palestinian prisoners and hostages and bodies held by Israel, and the reconstruction plan that is supposed to be implemented under the supervision of Egypt and Qatar, the two main mediators of this agreement, together with the United Nations. Now, as you mentioned, this multi-stage deal is essentially identical to the one presented by former President Biden in late May of last year, which Biden said at the time was not so much an American proposal, but rather a proposal that had been formulated by the Israelis and presented by the Americans in Washington. And now the Qatari Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, Sheikh Mohammed Abdel Rahman Al-Thani, has said that, in fact, the deal is also very close to what had initially been proposed in December of 2023, shortly after the temporary ceasefire and limited exchange of captives took place and then collapsed because Israel decided to resume the war. What happened is that after Biden presented the Israeli agreement in late May and then Hamas accepted it in early July of last year, something that Netanyahu did not expect, he began adding new conditions, such as that Israel would maintain an indefinite presence in what is called the Netzarim Corridor, which essentially bisects the Gaza Strip into north and south, that Israel would maintain a indefinite, read, permanent presence in what Israel calls the Philadelphia Corridor, which is the border zone between Gaza and Egypt, that Israel would retain freedom of action within the Gaza Strip. Essentially, the deal that Netanyahu is proposing is that Israel will retrieve all its captives and hostages and then resume its genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip. And under Biden, the Americans went along with this. They basically claimed falsely, as we now know, that the only reason the deal was not being consummated was because Hamas was refusing to accept it, whereas we now know the real reason. And this has been made clear not only by everyone who has looked into this, but even by Netanyahu's own negotiators. The real reason was that Israel kept proposing new conditions and changes designed to make it impossible for Hamas to accept an amended deal. And Hamas essentially said that they're only going to accept the deal that had been proposed by Biden. They did show some flexibility in terms of the wording and the sequencing and so on, but there were no major changes. So then, as you rightly ask, well, what happened? Why is Israel suddenly accepting the agreement that it had rejected for the past half year? Well, the key issue is that the American attitude changed. The incoming Trump administration made clear to the Israelis that the incoming president did not want a foreign policy crisis on his hands on the day he entered office, and he absolutely did not want a crisis on his hands that also included American hostages in the Middle East, because several of the Israelis being held in the Gaza Strip are also dual nationals. In other words, they're also U.S. citizens. And it was as a result of basically Israel being given its marching orders that Netanyahu came to the conclusion it was not a very good idea to get on Trump's bad side at the very outset of his tenure and went along with this agreement. You know, Trump had said on several occasions after the election that if there is no deal, there will be hell to pay. And everyone interpreted this as a threat to Hamas, which I'm sure it was, but it wasn't a threat directed solely at Hamas. It was a threat directed at everyone involved. Finish the deal and make sure there's a ceasefire by January 20th. Israeli analysts have also pointed out that there are other factors that have now made it easier for Netanyahu to accept a deal. And they're talking about, you know, one thing that we have now that we didn't have last summer is that Israel has successfully eliminated two leaders of Hamas, has managed to decimate the leadership of Hezbollah. It has bombed Iran, and of course, the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad has collapsed and is no more. That has led to improved poll numbers for Netanyahu, an expansion of his coalition, making it easier for him to accept the deal and lose a few of his coalition partners. But then there is also the explanation that was put forward by the Biden administration, and particularly by former Secretary of State Antony Blinken. And can I just say what a relief it is to be able to say former Secretary of State Antony Blinken. He said that it was the pressure Hamas felt because of all these Israeli military achievements that I just mentioned that finally compelled a weakened and isolated Hamas to accept what it had been rejecting throughout the second half of 2024. It's a bald-faced lie, to put it politely, because, first of all, Hamas had already accepted this agreement in early July 2024. And secondly, and more importantly, all these developments that were enumerated, the assassinations of the Hamas leaders, regime change in Syria, the decimation of the Hezbollah leadership, and so on, took place after Hamas had already accepted the proposal. So they were completely irrelevant to its calculations at the time that it made its decision to play ball.
Well, you'd almost think that the Biden administration's goal was to let Israel do all its destructive work, and it largely accomplished it.
Yes.
Decimated the resistance, it's destroyed Gaza, and there's not much left to bomb. It was just buying time to complete the work, and now the work is done?
That's an entirely appropriate way to look at it. There's virtually nothing left to bomb in the Gaza Strip now that there's a suspension of hostilities.
Yeah, now we've seen isolated pictures of that, but yes, now that we can see this full landscape,
exactly,
it's just appalling to look at. It's like Hiroshima.
And as some people have pointed out, it's probably a greater level of destruction than in Hiroshima. There's literally nothing left standing. Having said that, just regarding your comment about Hamas, I can't imagine that Hamas is not significantly weakened and depleted, but it was hardly a defeated organization. I mean, just in the last month, in Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia, the two towns in the far north of the Gaza Strip, immediately abutting the boundary with Israel, Israeli forces were incurring some of their heaviest losses during the past year, because for all its losses, and regardless of how much it had been weakened, it retains a capacity to fight and to fight coherently and to arm itself, and most importantly, to generate new recruits to replace those that it has lost.
None of this ceasefire and the accompanying agreement have anything to say about the future of the occupied territories, do they? I mean, the long-term political solution, who will govern these places, who will own these places, that remains very much up in the air.
Yes, and those are in fact two separate issues. There's the issue of, let's call it the day after scenario, which primarily concerns post-war governance, what type of government, what type of administration. And then there is a much broader and much more fundamental issue, which is the political future of the Gaza Strip in the context of the political future of the occupied Palestinian territory and the broader question of Israeli-Palestinian relations and all the rest of it. On the first point, the reason there is no agreement on that is because Israel, since October of 2023, and I should add to the frustration of its Western allies, and then particularly in Washington, has refused to put forward any proposal of its own about post-war governance. The Americans have strongly promoted the idea of the Palestinian Authority, which is now ensconced in the West Bank, taking over the administration of the Gaza Strip, essentially entering the Gaza Strip on the back of Israeli tanks. But this has been categorically rejected by Israel. Israel has at certain points suggested that it can find pliant clan leaders to do its bidding, but that's not working either. I think that reflects Israel's vision that there should be no Palestinian future in the Gaza Strip, that they've worked very hard to make this territory uninhabitable, unfit for organized human life. So why should there be any post-war governance there apart from the Israelis? At the same time, I think Hamas also recognizes that it cannot simply reconstitute itself and maintain its hegemonic rule over the Gaza Strip the way that it has ruled the territory between its seizure of power in 2007 and October 2023. And in fact, a month or two ago, an agreement was reached between Hamas and the Fatah movement, which forms a backbone of the Palestinian Authority. An agreement was reached in Cairo under Egyptian auspices, according to which a government will be established in the Gaza Strip that is politically neutral, what's called a technocratic government, that will not include personalities that are openly or clearly affiliated with either Hamas or with Fatah. These are supposed to be independents, if you will. but the body itself and its members will enjoy the consent of both parties. Now, this becomes a little tricky because this is an agreement that was reached between Hamas and Fatah. It is being strongly promoted by the Egyptians. But the jack-in-the-box here is the Palestinian Authority leader, Mahmoud Abbas, who has yet to endorse the agreement reached by his own negotiators. And I think what's at play here is he doesn't want to touch Hamas with a 10-foot pole because he's concerned that even an agreement that doesn't include any role for Hamas in Gaza governance, but includes governance with the consent of Hamas, will make it more difficult for him to engage with the Americans and potentially the Europeans as well. And the Israelis, of course, categorically reject any such agreement because from their perspective, one of their original war aims was not only to eradicate Hamas as a military force, but also as a governing authority.
I'm speaking with the journalist and political analyst Muin Rabbani. Some people have expressed skepticism about the story that Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, laid down the line with Netanyahu, and Netanyahu fell into line, saying this is just PR to buy some time, to have a smooth inauguration. First of all, do you think this story is believable? And longer term, what next? Trump is talking about Gaza's potential as a seaside resort. Jared Kushner said something similar last year.
Yes.
What do they have in mind? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't know if they have anything in mind. Let me just answer the first part of your question first, is that we've had multiple reports from multiple sources providing details of the Trump transition team's interactions with the Israelis, and specifically about his Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff's meetings with Netanyahu. These seem entirely credible. The general tenor that the Trump administration read the Riot Act to Netanyahu and told him to get into line, to me, seems entirely believable. There isn't a better explanation of why Netanyahu had been rejecting this agreement throughout the past 6 months, had never come under any pressure from the Biden administration to sign on to it. And all of a sudden, as soon as Trump's people got involved, the second and I think more important part of your question, what do the Americans have in mind? Here it's much less clear because we do know that Trump's people absolutely did not want a crisis on January 20th. Is that all they cared about? Are they now going to lose interest given that Gaza and the Middle East did not interfere with the inauguration? If they now lose interest, does this mean that Netanyahu can now derail the agreement after its first stage to ensure that the second and third stages of this agreement are not implemented? Or will they remain on top of things and keep the pressure on to ensure that the rest of this agreement is implemented? And there are conflicting signs here. I mean, on the one hand, we have Witkoff not only saying that he intends to remain personally engaged, but there's even suggestions that he will soon be visiting the Gaza Strip, and in a quote attributed to him, to ensure that there are no provocations to derail the agreement. And he then made a point of saying, and I'm not only talking about Hamas. Those are words we'd never have heard from any of Biden's people. And then there's the larger context. Yes, you know, they've talked about the Gaza beachfront as if this is essentially a real estate deal and not a political crisis or a decades-long issue of occupation and self-determination and so on. But I think the other issue here is that while we're very much focused on U.S.-Israeli relations, we would do well to pay equal attention to U.S.-Saudi relations. And why am I saying this? You may recall that during his first term, Trump, through Prince Jared of Kushner, engineered a normalization agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, then Bahrain, then Morocco. And the big prize was seen as Saudi-Israeli normalization. That didn't occur. Biden made it the centerpiece of his Middle East policy, at least until October 2023, and even after that, and also didn't achieve it. Will Trump now return to this item? Will he make this the centerpiece of his Middle East diplomacy? The reasons to believe that he will. We then have to see how the Saudis respond. Will the Saudis simply go along with it without seeking to impose any conditions regarding the Palestinians, simply to curry favor with the Americans the way that the Emiratis and the Bahrainis did? Will they assess that this is simply not going to happen because the Israelis are too extreme and won't be willing and won't be pressured by the Americans to make any significant political moves? And will the Saudis therefore focus much more on concluding a bilateral Saudi-American agreement? Or will the Saudis go to Trump and say, we want to do this, this is what needs to happen, an end to occupation, whatever other political arrangements that would fundamentally transform Israeli-Palestinian relations. You, Trump, get not only to sell many billions more of weapons, and we keep the Chinese role in Saudi Arabia limited, and we limit our relations with Russia, and as a bonus, you get a Nobel Peace Prize. If the Saudis do that, Trump may very well go for it. That will, of course, I think, create very significant tensions in Washington between the various elements of his own constituency, where you have kind of a collection of neocons, Israel firsters, Christian evangelists, isolationists, people who feel that the U.S. is being led by the nose by Israel and so on. So these are things I think that have yet to materialize, and we'll know much more in the next few months. Does Trump have a clear agenda for the Middle East? If he does, who is going to be formulating that agenda? Or were they simply focused on the transition and don't really care what happens next? And then, of course, there's also the broader question of Iran, where conditions now are very different than they were during the first Trump administration.
Meanwhile, Israel is ramping up military activities in the West Bank. What's going on there?
One issue, just getting back to an earlier question of yours, another point that has been raised by a number of observers and analysts is that there was supposed to have been all kinds of negotiations and haggling and deal-making involved between Witkoff and Netanyahu, in other words, between the United States and Israel, and that Israel got a variety of U.S. commitments in exchange for accepting the ceasefire deal. I'm not persuaded. When people talk about Trump agreeing to at least partial Israeli annexation of the West Bank, that may well happen, but that was already on the U.S. agenda during the election campaign. My suspicion is that it was much more limited than that, that Trump's people basically told Netanyahu, these are your marching orders, this is what's going to happen, and regarding any quid pro quo or what comes next, we'll talk about that in January, February. Now, as far as the West Bank is concerned, that was not an issue for the Americans because it didn't have the same resonance. What that means is that Israel essentially has a free hand in the West Bank because it's not really registering on Washington's radar yet. And Netanyahu is partially compensating for accepting this deal by very significantly ramping up Israel's rampages by both the military and the settlers in the West Bank. And this appears to have been part of a deal between Netanyahu and his finance minister, the far-right religious Zionism movement led by Bezalel Smotrich, who, unlike Ben-Gvir, did not leave the government but stayed within it. And it seems that intensifying Israel's rampages through the West Bank and land seizures and so on was part of that deal.
Finally, you alluded to this earlier, but let's talk a bit more about it. Gaza is a wreck. It's not possible to imagine any civilization being reestablished there. So what's ahead? What are we going to do? Like 2 million people who are essentially homeless.
Yes, 2 million people who are essentially homeless. Israel's initial intention, one, by the way, that was endorsed and embraced by the Biden administration and specifically by the former Secretary of State, Blinken, the initial proposal was to transfer, in other words, to forcibly deport the Palestinian population of the Gaza Strip to the Sinai Peninsula, open the border, push them all out, close the gate, problem solved. Blinken, in fact, went to the region and met with officials in the Gulf states and in Egypt and proposed this plan. And much to his surprise, Washington's closest Arab allies categorically rejected it. It has been suggested that the Egyptian strongman, Abd al-Fattah al-Sisi, was in principle prepared to consider that, but was met with very strong pushback from other power centers in the Egyptian security establishment. But my sense is that, at least for the foreseeable future, that objective or that plan is no longer on the agenda. It's no longer considered feasible. And I suspect what Israel wants to do now is to create conditions within the Gaza Strip where, if you don't have kind of an organized mass departure of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip, you will have a situation similar to what you've had, for example, in Syria or in North Africa, where people will get into boats or fishing trawlers or rubber dinghies, try to make it to the nearest island or landmass, and either make it or drown in the Mediterranean, like so many thousands before them. Having said that, while I generally agree with your statement about the Gaza Strip, certainly in its current form, not being a viable place for human civilization, we do have somewhat of a historical analogy here. And that's the late 1940s. What I'm pointing to specifically is that the Gaza Strip did not exist before 1948. You had Gaza City, certainly one of the oldest cities in the world. And during the British Mandate of Palestine, you had the District of Gaza, which was very much larger than the current Gaza Strip. But the Gaza Strip itself is a product of the Palestine War of the late 1940s, and particularly of the Nakba, the mass dispossession and expulsion of Palestinians from territory that became the State of Israel. And overnight, the population of what became the Gaza Strip more than tripled from 80,000 to, I believe it was, 240 or 250,000. These were all destitute, penniless, uprooted people who often entered the Gaza Strip on foot with only the clothes on their backs or on donkey carts. And there are actually very detailed reports at the time from, for example, the Quakers, an organization that was quite active in the Gaza Strip during the late 1940s and subsequently from UN agencies that were there. So you had, yes, Gaza's infrastructure was certainly more prepared than it is today, but it was similarly in no way able to absorb three times the existing population. Yet, as I always say, one should never underestimate the resourcefulness and the persistence of the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip. I mean, we're talking about people here who were under blockade and siege for 17 years. For a prolonged period, were not even able to get fuel into the Gaza Strip to run their vehicles and found a way to use cooking oil to make their cars run and have taxi transportation and all the rest of it. Yes, the challenges are going to be enormous. We don't yet know to what extent they will be supported either by Arab states or the international community, or whether, you know, once the guns fall silent, if people will just move on to the next crisis. But this is an extraordinarily resourceful people that has managed to build a viable society out of nothing once before and may well succeed in doing so again, particularly if the underlying political crisis that is now in its eighth decade and that ultimately explains a crisis that erupted on October 7th of 2023 is also addressed.
That's a big qualification.
Yes, I readily concede that point.
That was Mouin Rabbani, who is, among other things, co-editor of Jadalia, an e-zine on Middle Eastern affairs. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Thank you.
That's some of the slow movement for string quartet and early work by Anton Webern, composed when he was 22, about 20 years before he went atonal, performed by the Emerson Quartet. Next, a radical and I hope not unsettling change of gears, Sex Work Today. We're joined by two of the three editors of a book by that title from NYU Press, Bernadette Barton and Angela Jones. The third co-editor, whom we're not hearing from, is Barbara Brentz. It's a collection of 31 essays on that broad topic, ranging from disability and race to fighting the cops to mutual aid and the increasing presence of AI chatbots. The first voice you'll hear is that of Angela Jones. Subordinated and marginalized populations are often very divided among themselves, and sex workers are no exceptions. There's what's called a horarchy, a hierarchy among sex workers. Could you describe what that's like?
So the horarchy is a term that sex workers created that really recognizes the critical importance of understanding sexual labor through an intersectional frame, which is to say, quite to put more plainly, that industry segment matters, worker subjectivity and identity matters in shaping people's experiences. So, for example, sex workers' labor experiences are going to vary tremendously based on whether or not they're performing full-service sex work, whether or not they're working in brothels, whether they're working in the camming industry or porn industry or sugaring, and all of these different segments of sexual commerce.
What happens with the horarchy is that it's a ranking, it's a hierarchical system where, and it's a kind of horizontal hostility or lateral violence within a group or between groups where some sex workers say, you know, I'm better, I'm an exotic dancer and I don't do full service work, so therefore I'm better than full service workers. And usually that horarchy is arranged according to how much contact a sex worker has with the customer and the police.
Yeah, the riskier the job, the lower the prestige.
Yes,
generally speaking.
Yeah, of course it's all risky, degrees of risk. Okay, this is a field where labor conditions, actually the whole condition of the industry has changed enormously over the last few decades, mostly thanks to the internet. So how does sex work today differ from what it was several decades ago?
So I would say that the internet, as you've already noted, Doug, has diversified sexual industries and labor. So the available job opportunities and labor opportunities have expanded online. So we see more opportunities. One thing that the book covers is what a lot of folks in porn industries have thought about as a kind of democratization of porn or an opening up of opportunities. The influx of amateur pornography in particular online has created opportunities, for example, for people who may have previously been shut out of studio porn industries due to their race, their body size, their gender, their sexuality. And so there's increasing opportunities online. Now, with that, I don't think Bernadette, I, or Barb want to paint any of these industries as some kind of economic utopia or paradise, right? In that the more people who gravitate, especially to online markets, which do provide far more safety than offline markets, right? So it's understandable while people may be gravitating more to online sex work, there's more autonomy. Again, more physical safety. But at the same time, as more people gravitate towards these online markets, those markets become saturated. And so we know that in any economy, when there is an influx or a significant number of workers, this is going to drive down wages. And so increasingly, we're finding that even though there's more opportunities and diverse opportunities, that increasingly sex workers are reporting that they really have to hustle, which is to say that maybe they're camming on these particular platforms on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and then they're also kind of sexting or doing phone sex on Sex Panther or some other platform on Wednesdays, you know, or maybe they're also working as a dominatrix offline. And so increasingly these conditions, even though there's widened opportunities, also means that there is increased competition, lower wages for those jobs.
What you're saying is a reminder that sex work is work, and like labor in general, there's just a tremendous hierarchy here, a tremendous hierarchy of earnings, of success and failure. It's just an extremely competitive world, and some people may rake it in, but most don't.
Absolutely, and I think this goes back to your first insightful question about the horarchy, which is also to say that when we think intersectionally, we should be thinking a lot about how factors such as race and nation and age and ability shape who is earning significant amounts of money, for example, online, and who is not.
As I'm recalling, OnlyFans was founded in 2016, but it really took off during the pandemic. How has that changed the landscape?
Sites like OnlyFans, like you said, grew dramatically. So what we're seeing, and I'm actually drawing on some of Angela's work right here, is that the democratization of sex work allows, as Dr. Jones shared, so many more folks to enter into different identities, to engage in sex work online. But we see that this computer mediation, so having a screen, creates a psychological barrier for sex workers with customers that allows for the sex workers some easier emotional management.
While OnlyFans was founded in 2016, due to the unfortunate conditions of the global pandemic, many people found themselves, especially low-wage end workers, found themselves looking for alternative forms of employment. And so there was this surge, by millions, surge of users in 2020. But I think it's important to note first and foremost that sex workers have been using other types of clips platforms to post their own content long before OnlyFans showed up. So OnlyFans is really one platform in a very expansive market of platforms where content creators can post and sell and share their content. One of the things that happened in 2020, though, that I think is interesting around OnlyFans is that there was a lot of increased coverage of OnlyFans, and in ways that I think presented really misguided understandings of what was happening in online sexual commerce, which is to say, I think that there was almost a romanticization. There was so much popularity around OnlyFans and the diverse number of people who are finding themselves on the platform that I think it created this sense that anybody could kind of create an account on OnlyFans. This is really easy. You just post content and you're going to make fortunes, right? And we know that Horatio Alger dies really hard on this platform. Which is to say that most people are not logging into OnlyFans and making a significant amount of money. That, again, the platform itself in 2020 became incredibly saturated with content and with performers, which drove down wages. And again, thinking about this intersectionally, who's the most likely to be successful on a platform like OnlyFans is shaped by aspects of subjectivity. So a worker's race, their gender, their sexuality.
I actually want to talk about your chapter a little later. So before we get there, this is a good point, I think, to talk about Bernadette Barton's co-written chapter on the feminist sex wars. This talk of democratization can obscure a whole lot of explicit or implicit power relations that people might not want to talk about in a sunnier view of sex work. First of all, could you remind us of what the feminist sex wars are all about? And after that, you have an idea about trying to get beyond it. So talk about it as well.
So the feminist sex wars are generally dated back to 1982, which was when there was a conference called the Barnard Conference on Sexuality, and there was kind of an explosion of difference among feminists. And roughly when folks talk about the feminist sex wars, they divide feminists between radical feminists and sex radical feminists. Radical feminists understand the sex industry as a phenomenon that is oppressive to women, that solidifies women's second-class status relative to men in a sexist world, and they are against the sex industry. Sex radical feminists typically say, yes, that is the case, but that's not the end of the story. In fact, sex work can create opportunities for women on an individual level where it allows women to meet her financial needs and in some cases even do work that she enjoys for at least a time. Part of the confusion about the feminist sex wars is that radical feminists tend to analyze the sex industry from an institutional or macro or sort of large scale perspective. Whereas sex radical feminists look at the sex industry from a more individualistic lens. Radical feminists are emphasizing this idea that women should live lives free from sexism. And sex radical feminists instead are focusing on the ability of an individual to experience sexual freedom, both personally and professionally. So what we do in the chapter with Dr. Brianna Foss is explore this dynamic and say that, in fact, we need both. We need both the radical feminist analysis and the sex radical analysis. We need to live lives that are free of sexism as well as experience sexual freedom. And we need to attend to the diversity of our experiences that we have by race, by class, by disability level, by gender identity, etc.
following up on the OnlyFans thing, people applauded OnlyFans as a way of getting through the pandemic. But on the other hand, it's also testimony to the fact that we have a very flimsy welfare state, and people just, if they're out of work or suffering some kind of life crisis, there's just no social support to speak of. So it seems important to keep both those things in mind.
That's for sure. And I can speak anecdotally, and Angela, maybe you can chime in too. I know my students often make, they're being funny, but they're like, I should get an OnlyFans account to pay for school. So those kinds of comments are said quite often in a gender studies classroom, which I think say something. And then when I ask them, how many of your friends have said this? They're like, oh yeah, like 3/4 of them. So the young people are seeing it as a way to survive precarious economic circumstances.
There is, though, a chapter on feminist porn. Speaking of feminism, what's that all about?
Pornography has always reflected the inequalities in mainstream culture from the beginning, from postcards to films to videos to streaming culture. So pornography is sexist, racist, transphobic, and so on, eroticizing inequality for mostly cisgender heterosexual men. But there are folks intervening in this incredibly misogynist space, like Kelsey Burke, Dr. Kelsey Burke, and Inka Winters. Burke and Winter, they trace Inka's journey to becoming a feminist porn creator. So it's like, how do we deal with this space that prioritizes men's experience? And how can we intervene as feminists to provide content for people that is more feminist? So Inka Winter developed a 4Play Films. And the article basically is an intervention in the swamp of misogyny in most mainstream porn. So she develops content that centers women's pleasure and mutual pleasure and respect and consent. So feminist porn, though it's available, is still, of course, a very small amount of the content online. And it's niche, but it's really good that it exists.
That was the voice of Bernadette Barton, one of three editors, along with Angela Jones, whom we're also hearing from, and Barbara Brentz of Sex Work Today, Erotic Labor in the 21st Century, published by NYU Press. Another problem with the democratization line is that sex workers face enormous practical challenges, like difficulties with banks and payment processors. It's a firing offense at a day job. Talk about some of these challenges that just make it so hard to get through the day-to-day. I think there's this image in some people's minds that sex workers are living lives of ease and luxury and almost enviable situation, but actually it's pretty tough, right?
Yeah, absolutely, to say the least, Doug. Sex workers face rampant occupational discrimination. And I think that it's really important to underscore the effects of this discrimination. When you're cut out from an entire banking system, an entire financial system, it has implications for your ability to secure housing, for your ability to acquire insurance, for your very ability to support and maintain yourself. And when I say being cut off from a financial system, what many people may not know, what many of our writers and essayists talk about, is the way that they face discrimination through various banking institutions. So, for example, credit card companies, MasterCard, banks, Chase, Wells Fargo, and I'm only naming a couple, payment processors such as PayPal and Cash App refuse to process payments for sex workers, including legal sex industries such as pornography. And so, again, being cut out of entire financial systems has really tremendous and adverse effects on sex workers' abilities to support themselves and live.
Yeah, one of the chapters mentions Mr. Snow, who is an academic whose advisor disowned her because she found out she was a dominatrix. But Mr. Snow also had her, I think it was a DoorDash account canceled simply because she was a sex worker. I mean, that's pretty extreme stuff.
I was just going to bring up Fosta Sesta. I know you didn't ask about that.
Oh, yes, I should have, yes.
Yeah, a lot of this happened after Fosta Sesta became law, where platforms began to censor the sexual content.
Could you decode the acronyms there?
Oh, my gosh, what is it? Fight?
You don't have to spell it out. I just mean, what does it mean?
Oh, so these are laws that were passed, I believe, in 2018 to reduce human trafficking. By making online platforms liable for user-generated content that might facilitate sex trafficking in some way. But what happened, the consequence, was that it removed online spaces for workers to connect with and vet the customers And then it exacerbated misinformation about trafficking and ended up overall worsening labor conditions. And ironically, made sex trafficking more likely since workers can't as easily share information about dangerous customers.
Yeah, the trafficking discourse. Trafficking discourse is really big, and there's a whole rescue industry that's grown up related to it. What's a good way to think about all that?
Well, one way to think about it is that sex work is not sex trafficking. And so policies and rescue industries like religious organizations that have homes that women can go to leave the sex industry, which on the face of it, you know, can be a good service, but when they require, of course, a kind of religiosity and or treat everyone as though they're a sex trafficking victim, they're confusing voluntary workers with victims of abuse. And that has a lot of negative consequences. You know, it casts all sex workers as victims, and then it ends up neglecting the needs of actual sex workers to earn a wage, and it supports anti-immigrant measures, and then reinforces all kinds of stereotypes that support neocolonialism.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, the trafficking people want to rescue these victims, but they overlook the fact that many of them went into sex work because the rest of their economic lives were so precarious that sex work was something of a refuge. So rescuing people from that is not very helpful.
Well, and if you eliminate the dimension of choice, you just disempower workers.
Right. And what I think is really important to underscore is that the rescue industry rarely ever helps sex workers, full stop. So ultimately, a lot of these organizations, they end up, and especially the criminal legal system, ends up arresting sex workers, not providing them with any of the resources. So even if people are facing some amount of third-party coercion, the criminal legal system does nothing to alleviate any of the issues, the structural issues that led them to being coerced. So put another way, if the rescue industry actually wants to help people who are experiencing coercion, then they need to address issues of poverty, racism, and so forth. They need to address the structural issues that made people susceptible to coercion in the first place. And again, the criminal legal system, the social service system, very often does very little to actually help people who are experiencing coercion. And I think people need to know that.
It does make people like Nick Kristoff feel very good about themselves.
Very good about themselves.
Angela Jones, a chapter you co-wrote, as you point out, not much work has been done on trans, especially transmasculine and non-binary sex workers. I want to talk about that. But in the early part of that chapter, there's some really interesting numbers on relative earnings by demographic slice. Could you give us some measure of the hierarchy of wages?
Yeah. So I wrote a chapter in our collection with Elliot Chudik. Specifically on the experiences of trans masculine and non-binary sex workers. And this need came out of the fact that so much of the research on trans sex workers focuses primarily on trans feminine sex workers, and most often from a public health lens, which is to say a lot of that research only focuses on things like HIV and treats trans women more as like a problem to be solved than as actual workers and human beings with needs. And we wanted to address some of those issues. One of the things that Elliot and I found was that when it came to trans masculine and non-binary sex workers, you could really see the way that gender and other factors such as race were shaping people's incomes in really uneven ways. The data that we both collected has suggested, for example, that trans masculine escorts and full service providers are some of the lowest paid folks in the escort or full service market. And that they often have to deal with a significant amount of cissexism, prejudice, and misunderstanding about their identities and their lives. They often find themselves doing a lot of education with clients. One of the things that I've written about in other publications has been that what's important about these identity-based differences is that they can also shape who feels empowered in their vetting processes, in their screening processes, for example, to demand payment upfront, to demand condom usage. So if you're working class, trans man, who is of color, who is, you know, facing a lot of economic precarity, it may influence whether or not you feel empowered to demand condom usage. It really affects workers' harm reduction practices in ways that are important. And as much as I think it's important to focus on inequality, discrimination, and some of the kind of adverse effects of their labor or adverse experiences of their labor. Elliot and I also make space to talk quite a bit about trans joy as well.
Yeah, you anticipated my next question.
Yes. So one of the things that I found across my research has been that, especially with trans sex workers, that folks have said, listen, there can be lots of limitations to the work that I do. You know, I often confront trans misogyny or other forms of cissexism in their labor, and they are sure to underscore those experiences. But one of the things that also comes through is the way that sex work for some folks has been a path to experience gender euphoria, not just gender dysphoria, right? But it becomes a space through which to grapple with gender dysphoria and ultimately experience gender euphoria, which is another way of saying, you know, when you have clients respect your body, when you have clients affirm your gender, when you have clients who are telling you that you are the most beautiful person in the world, right? And again, are affirming your gender and how you understand yourself, especially in a world that doesn't, that can bring experiences joy.
Of course, you want to be seen as a full human and not just some kind of fetish object.
Exactly, exactly.
That was the voice of Angela Jones, one of three co-editors of Sex Work Today, Erotic Labor in the 21st Century, published by NYU Press. We've also been hearing from Bernadette Barton, another of the three editors. Alas, we've not been hearing from the third, Barbara Brentz. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of another early work by Anton Webern, his piano quintet, written when he was 24, performed by the Ensemble Intercontemporain, founded by Pierre Boulez, whose collection of the complete Webern this performance comes from. Till next week, bye.